Hello, I'm Kathleen Dunn, and this is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio for this Tuesday, the 26th of October. Our guest this hour is the author of Big Girls Don't Cry, The Election That Changed Everything for American Women. Rebecca Traister is our guest this hour. Rebecca writes about politics and gender for Salon. She has contributed to a number of other publications. And this is a great book. It looks at, she calls herself a feminist journalist, allied neither with the generations of second wave or third wave activists that preceded her, nor with the online rabble of younger women who are redefining the movement as she types, as she typed this book. She was born, she writes, in 1975 to a mother who taught her, not by instruction but by example, that it was not only possible for a woman to participate fully in academic, professional, and economic spheres, but pretty much expected. And she used to go to the voting booth with her mom and dad, and she starts her book with that, which we'll ask her to talk about. The book is wonderful because she was she spent a lot of time with the candidates and highly involved in the 2008 election, which, you know, as far as I'm concerned, is one of the most interesting ones of my life, which is becoming fairly long now. She writes about a more complicated version of Michelle Obama, which is just fascinating, and how she got to know her while following her in Iowa. She writes about Elizabeth Edwards and John Edwards and Bill Clinton and, of course, Hillary Clinton and Sarah Palin and Republican women, whether or not Sarah Palin is a feminist. How things changed in 2008. Rebecca, I'm sure you'll enjoy the interview, has written a wonderful book, and we'll welcome phone calls for her. Our number is 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655. And if you would like to send an email, okay, that's talk@WPR.org, talk@WPR.org. Hi, Rebecca. Thanks so much for being with us.
Hi, Kathleen. Hi. It's a pleasure.
Oh, great pleasure to have you here. So we do bring our children to the voting booth. It's not for naught, because there you were when you were 9 years old, and I think it influenced the whole course of your life. What do you think?
Well, I think so. I mean, I always remembered it, you know. It's not something I sat around and thought about every day. The particular instance I remember, and it was the first time, which always been taken to the voting booth, but the time that my father, in particular, brought me in so that I could pull the lever and mark the X, was in 1984 when I was 9 years old, and it was so that I could pull the lever for Geraldine Ferraro. And, you know, this was always my memory, the first time you go into one of those booths and you see, because I'd been before and seen my parents behind the curtains, but this is the first time I had gone in and actually done the pressing of the buttons and the pulling of the lever. And, of course, it's like this mysterious adult thing that adults do opened up to you. So, of course, you remember it. And I also remembered that this was a historic moment. My father and both my parents, my mother took my brother into her voting booth so he could do the same. He was younger than I. And it's funny, the 2008 election is what brought the power of that back to me, what it meant to vote for somebody who the kind of person we'd never been able to vote for before. And I was lucky enough, because I did wind up voting for Hillary Clinton and then I voted for Barack Obama in the general election. I got to do that twice in 2008. You know, but those kinds of, in those small moments, which are simultaneously private because it's us in the booth with the buttons, and public because we're participating in the democracy, those small moments are when we change history, and that's, or try to change history, and by the trying, we do anyway. And those things are so powerfully emotional. You know, participating in the development and progress of your nation is a profoundly moving and thrilling experience. And I think on some level I got my first taste of that when I was 9 years old, and I saw it again. In fact, working at Salon.com, my colleague, a video producer, Caitlin Schamberg, and I made a video of the general election day in November of kids, little kids going in to vote for Barack Obama.
Oh, did you really?
Parents.
Oh,
and we saw
wonderful.
That again.
Oh, that's wonderful. And talk about an emotional election. In a campaign. That campaign, I got to tell you, I was involved in watching that campaign. I never watched so much television in my whole life. I was really interested, keenly interested in all that was happening in that campaign. And I'm so happy you wrote the book, because it was Barack Obama and Hillary Clinton, and it was Michelle Obama and Sarah Palin and all of that. It was just, it was highly emotional, and just it made you so happy to be in this country during that election, didn't it?
Yes. Well, it was one of the most riveting elections.
Yes, it was.
Certainly of my life. And I think for generations, it was one of the most riveting elections. And I would argue that one of the reasons that it was so mind-bogglingly exciting and why it had us sort of on the edge of our seats and we couldn't wait to turn the page and see what happened next was because it involved characters that were unlike any characters we'd seen before, and therefore that made voters behave in ways we hadn't seen before. This is what happens when you introduce new people to a story that has been told again and again and again, which is not to take away from the history and excitement of the presidency through our two centuries of American history, but it had always been, presidents and candidates for presidents had always been drawn from the same group of people, from white men in America. Obviously very different ideological men, we've had a million different kinds of presidents, but here was a story in which the cast of characters was totally new, and therefore the way that we responded to them was totally new. And so what you had was an election that surprised you at every turn.
Yeah, I like the way you put that, a new cast of characters. If we could, please, because I think she's a remarkable woman, and I love the insights that you gave us in your book as to the more complicated version of Michelle Obama that you saw, particularly in Iowa. This is a highly accomplished woman who people love now, but they loved her when she walked into the gymnasium in Iowa.
Yes, they did. I went to profile Michelle Obama in November of 2007, and just to remind listeners of when that was, it was 2 months before the Iowa caucus, and it was coming off of several months in which her husband had been behind in the polls. It seemed extremely unlikely that he was going to be able to beat Hillary Clinton, certainly in the Iowa caucus and beyond. And so she was in Iowa campaigning for him, and I spent a few days following her around the campaign trail, and she was really, she took my breath away, and I never had the Obama mania that so many of my peers experienced during the primaries, but I had Michelle mania. In watching her in person, she was so brilliant and so electric, and it was deeply moving to me to be in these rooms full of people where every one of them felt connected to Michelle, and I understood, and I think they did too, but here, she was a new kind of woman. She was a, like Hillary Clinton in 1992, this was a dynamic, outspoken, articulate, opinionated, successful career woman who had a job she loved, who was committed to her family, who had ideas about the nation, who had ideas about her husband and his run for the presidency that were absolutely her own. And we had seen so few models of this in our history of first ladies. It's really true. Hillary Clinton had been the first lady when she came into the White House in 1992 who had had a career that was separate from her husband's political career. And, of course, she became a lightning rod. This was no small thing. This is still an explosive thing. And in Michelle Obama's case, of course, this was the first African, well, not the first, but now she is our first African-American first lady. And so here was this woman who's history-making in all kinds of ways, and yet the crowds were not, you know, they were so fully connected to her and talked about her. She is one of our own. And for me, who writes about powerful women and the sometimes ambivalent way that we react to them, it was so thrilling for me to see this powerful woman embraced by crowds.
Yeah, and to have people.
But that has, I mean, that story has now changed several times.
Right.
Michelle Obama has been transformed by handlers, and we have gone back to over the course of the campaign, because when Barack Obama won the nomination, there was a lot of concern about the level of both sexism and racism with which Michelle Obama was treated by the press, and she was depicted as a very stereotypical version of an angry black woman. And to counteract that, when Obama entered the general election, Michelle was given something of a makeover, so that the parts of her personality that were outspoken, opinionated, the element of Michelle that was very concerned with her own career, that was proudly ambitious and committed to her work life, all that stuff kind of got pushed aside. And all we hear now about Michelle is that she is a wife and mother, which are very authentic. She certainly is and has always been a proud wife and mother. But the other elements of her personality have been so tamped down that what we're left with are the maternal and the wifely in a way that is actually not so different from previous first ladies that we've seen.
She certainly has dropped some of those references to her husband, how he snores and he's kind of a grouch in the morning and doesn't clean up the butter dish, etc. We don't hear much of that anymore, do we?
We certainly do not.
No. You know, I have a friend who worked with both of them in Chicago and knows both of them and always has said wonderful things about Michelle. I'm sure that you think every now and then, as I do, what if she had been the candidate? What kind of dynamic would have that put, would that have put into this race? What if it had been Michelle?
Well, it's so funny because there are so many people who knew them in Chicago back at the start of Barack's political career, when he was rather an awkward and ungainly politician when he started off. It's hard to imagine now. And several people actually in the book told me Michelle was a superstar. We always thought she was the one who was a superstar and that Barack was going to be her competent partner. And of course, then there was this major power shift. It's hard to imagine Michelle as the candidate for one reason, which is that she has always expressed her distrust of and dislike of the political system. So unlike Hillary Clinton, who I think since her undergraduate days had an interest in making policy, I don't think Michelle Obama, I don't think that's been part of her ambition.
Mm-hmm.
I think she's had tremendous ambitions professionally, but that they have not included, for example, a run for the presidency. That said, were we to extend ourselves to try to imagine Michelle Obama as the candidate, we would have been dealing with, of course, her husband dealt with an enormous amount of racism and is still dealing with it. In her case, that racism would have been altered because there would have also been sexism involved. It is, as we begin to expand our imaginations so that we can envision more African-American presidents, more female presidents, more female African-American presidents, we have a lot of work to do. There would be an enormous amount of resistance with which Michelle Obama's candidacy for the presidency would have been met.
All right, let's move into Hillary Clinton, who also has redefined herself many, many times. And this discontent that you write about so well in the book, that some establishment feminists felt about Clinton's impending run, had become the undercurrent of many political conversations. We want to be for her. We think this is a good idea, but many people secretly wanted Obama. There was always this reservation about, for many women, you would think it would be her natural constituency, but there was a reservation about her. What was that all about?
Well, there are a number of factors involved. The first is that Hillary Clinton had almost 20 years of baggage with the American people. And she'd come in, you know, we'd sort of, most of us had met her in 1991 as Bill Clinton's wife while he was running for president. And again, she'd been this lightning rod. She had, so many women of her generation had forged an intense identification with her. Because she was so different from the first ladies who had preceded her, because she did represent, she was a public version of symbolic femininity, which is ultimately what the first lady role has been, a femininity that included a post-second wave version of being a woman in which you balance both work and family.
Mm-hmm.
And that was so brand new in terms of seeing it on a public stage, that so many women who had lives like that so fully identified with her and believed her to be just like them, that when she entered her own political career and had to make the inevitable compromises that you wind up making if you're going to position yourself to be president, and that is not exclusively about gender, that's about our electoral system, she began to make those compromises, and perhaps she had to make more of them because she was a woman and she was going to do something historically unprecedented. And so she had to maneuver herself with exceptional skill to be in a place where she could plausibly be considered a candidate for president. And she did that, but that process meant the shedding of a lot of the traits that those women had first identified with her. And so there was this feeling of this feeling of disappointment, the feeling that she was not what they'd hoped she'd be. And there's another factor in that, too, which is that when we're shut out of power, we are allowed to develop fantasies about what it would be like if we're in power, which is where you get the sort of fantasy vision of the first female president. And I'm sure we've all heard this, right? If we had a woman president, there'd be no wars. She'd be collaborative. You know, we'd have peace. She would pull over and ask for directions. And we get to engage in that kind of fantasy about how superior a female leader would be because we haven't had the reality of a female leader.
Yeah.
When we're greeted with an actual person who's running, and we discover that, in fact, her politics resemble those of the men who she's running against, there's a sort of disappointment. We've set the bar too high because we've only had our imaginations to work with, so we've imagined something perfect.
Mm-hmm.
And Hillary Clinton fell far short of perfect for many women on the left who had initially loved her so much.
I think there's
that's one of the things, by the way, that I think this election has done, and that we're even seeing now with some of the Republican women who are running. What we are doing is seeing a host of new kinds of women. This is Hillary Clinton's campaign did it. Sarah Palin's campaign did it. The women we're seeing on the stump right now are doing it. We are expanding the number of models we can have for what a woman might look like as she runs for office.
Oh, we
and
sure.
And that's good. Even when those campaigns are disappointing, even when the women disappoint us, that's actually good for us because we're getting away from that bar of perfection. We're seeing what political parity might actually look like, in that there will be terrific candidates and bad candidates, smart and stupid, right and left, old and young, and that there will be as many down the road varieties of female candidate as there are male candidates.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that's a crucial thing that we're beginning to see.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, we're definitely seeing it. I found this real fascinating, what you had to say, because it seemed as though Hillary Clinton did try to fashion herself in the way that Mark Penn, her campaign strategist, who was a bad person to have as her campaign strategist, but I found this fascinating. He sent her a memo saying most voters, in essence, see the president as the father of the country. They do not want someone who would be the first mama, especially in this kind of world, but they're open to the first father being a woman. The model for which Clinton should aim, Penn believed, was Margaret Thatcher, the Iron Lady. We don't think of her we don't think of good humor or warmth, but we think smart, tough leadership. And I think that that's how she fashioned herself during that campaign. So we didn't see much of the warmth. We needed to see that part of her.
Well, that's absolutely right. And that advice, Mark Penn was pretty much undeniably a bad strategist for Hillary Clinton. However, the larger theme behind that advice was not without historical precedent. Because what we've seen in recent decades as more women have entered the political process is an assumption based in reality that there was enough of a discomfort with the idea of female leadership that women who put themselves up to run needed to present themselves, needed to sort of de-sex themselves, to so de-emphasize their femininity that, you know, depending on the degree, they might almost be able to pass for male, to emphasize their toughness, you know, to not in any way call attention to the fact of their gender. And that has been the wisdom for decades. And I think we are seeing that change in front of our eyes. I think this is something we're seeing in the current election, too. And we first saw it transform while Hillary Clinton was running for president, because that was the advice. And Mark Penn's particular iteration of it may have been ham-handed. It certainly was. He was advising her basically to try to pass for male, to cross-dress. And if you look back at the beginning of Hillary Clinton's campaign, that's exactly what happened. All of her slogans were super pugilistic. I'm in it to win it. We're going to deck the patsies. I mean, it was all very boxing metaphor. And, of course, one of the complicating factors for Hillary Clinton was that her opponent in those primaries was Barack Obama, who, trying to de-emphasize his blackness, was behaving on the campaign trail as though he were a woman. He had Oprah as his campaign guru, and he was talking to crowds about how he felt, you know, he hoped and he dreamed and he wished, and using all this language that we think of as quite feminized. And so there was this these two people with different identities that hadn't been seen very much on a campaign trail were trying all these tricks and sort of eating each other's lunch in various instances. And what we saw with Hillary was that trying to pass as male, trying to get people to forget that there was anything historic about her run, that there was anything different about her, didn't work for her.
No, it sure didn't.
It sure didn't. But if you look at the arc of her campaign, starting in New Hampshire, and I'm not just talking about the purported crying. I'm actually talking about in the New Hampshire primary, after she lost Iowa, when she was widely predicted to lose the New Hampshire primary and essentially be out of the race that early on.
Mm-hmm.
Hillary Clinton kind of let go of Mark Penn's advice,
mm-hmm.
and she started speaking in what was much closer to her own voice. She called out sexism when guys stood up and held an Iron My Shirt sign. She actually used the word sexism, which women candidates are not supposed to do. She said, the remains of sexism alive and well. She chided Chris Matthews, and then she did have that moment where she didn't cry, but she became emotional in response
right.
to a question.
Yeah.
And these were moments that were absolutely off the Mark Penn script, in which she was being herself. And in that self, it's not like she was being particularly feminine, but she was being her female self. And voters came out and voted for her. And you saw that transformation. It was very slow, but by the end of the primary campaign, she was again finding her own voice and not trying to pass as something she wasn't. And we saw that work. And that is a very new approach to campaigning while female.
Yeah, and we will, in a moment, talk about the voice of Sarah Palin. I'm fascinated to find out what you thought when you first heard her speak, when you first heard the announcement that she was going to be the VP candidate, and where she has gone now to become this incredibly significant feature, woman in American politics. And we'll welcome phone calls. I'm sure we'll have many of them. We're speaking this hour of the program with the author of Big Girls Don't Cry. Rebecca Traister is with us. The election that changed everything for American women. 800-486-8655. Rebecca writes about politics and gender for Salon. Our email address, should you care to use that, is talk@WPR.org. talk@WPR.org. I'm Kathleen Dunn on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Rebecca Traister is our guest. I do want to tell you that as long as we're talking politics here this hour, we went to Springfield a year ago to celebrate Abraham Lincoln's 200th birthday and had just a wonderful time. You all said that you wanted to go to Washington next, so we're going to Washington next. March 30th through April 5, we're traveling to Gettysburg. We're going to do a broadcast from the NPR studios. We're going to look at the cherry blossoms. We're going to George and Martha Washington's home, and we'll see all of the sites in Washington, D.C. We hope that we'll be meeting with congressional representatives. It should be just a terrific time. We're taking the bus, and we all get along real well. We have similar interests, and everybody who takes trips like these loves history and politics and all of that. So if you would like more information about this trip, please contact Progressive Travel, and here's the phone number, 800-231-4391, 800-231-4391. This will be, let me give you the exact dates, March 30th through April 5 of next year, which should be cherry blossom time. We're going to have a good time. All right, let's go to Bob from Eau Claire before we get to Sarah Palin. Hi, Bob.
Morning.
Hi,
Bob.
Good. How are you?
I'm very well.
Good.
I just wanted to make a quick comment and then a quick question, if I may.
Sure.
My wife and I raised two children, a son and a daughter, and from an early age, and I'm talking, they were probably 6, 7 years old when we first started doing it. We probably did it the entire time that they were even munchkins. But they went to the polling place with us, and we voted for everything. School boards, local elections, the 2-year cycle, and the 4-year cycle. And when they got old enough so that they knew exactly what we were doing, and we lived in an area that used paper ballots, we would sit down, we would go over the ballots with them at home to discuss who our choices were and what was going on. And then when we went to the polling place, we gave them the pencil and said, go to it. And so they were, at a very early age, really keyed in to the political process, and as a consequence, they do that now. They're very politically active and aware. Our daughter was a volunteer with the Wellstone campaign, and she majored. One of her co-majors was political science. So we're really pleased with what we did, and we didn't think we were particularly unique or anything. We just thought that that was the right thing to do.
Yeah, I did that too. I was a little embarrassed when, you'll both get a kick out of this, when my son was two. I mean, I watch politics and have been involved all the time, so he would go with me to all the voting too. And when he was two, he knew who the candidates were, but he just announced to everybody in the whole polling area, "Mom, I voted for Bob Dole," because he liked Bob. He didn't know anything about the candidates. I think he liked the guy's name, Bob Dole, and he could say it. And I just cringed. I thought, oh, my gosh, you can't say that here.
There you go.
Oh, my. But you're right. Once,
that's cool.
Once you
okay,
do that.
Here's my question.
All right.
And I agree that we've got a bevy of women in politics who are serious and thoughtful. And I'm not a big fan of Sarah Palin's, but I give the woman her due. She certainly has rocketed to the forefront of the political scene. But even given that, I'm looking at some of the other players. I'm looking at Michelle Bachmann and Christine O'Donnell and Sharon Angle. And I look at these people and I just cringe, quite frankly. I think that they are incredibly, not with it, okay, for lack of a better term. And I'd like to hear your correspondence response.
All right,
that.
Bob. Thanks for the call.
Thank you, Bob. That's a terrific question and a very difficult one, because it's one that I've heard a lot in recent weeks as I've been talking about the book and doing readings, and people say, okay, so we have more women, but I want to put the mute button on when they're on television, you know, watching Christine O'Donnell not know what's in the First Amendment, hearing some of the things that come out of Michelle Bachmann's mouth, and this is very valid. This is not, we do, by the way, have a crop of, on both sides of the aisle, actually, and I write about this in the book. I'm a Democrat, but there are many accomplished women on the right and the left running for office. But the ones we're hearing about this election cycle are the ones, A, the extreme conservatives and extremist conservatives, and B, the ones who do not appear to be particularly prepared for office. And that is very difficult. But let me address that a little bit. There is no question that some of these people are not terrific, articulate candidates, and that they have made statements that make you cringe. I would also argue, however, that the attention that the media is putting on these female candidates who are saying things that make you cringe is giving us a false impression that it's only women out there saying these things. When it comes to the kind of some of the intensely extremist conservative views espoused by, say, Michelle Bachmann or Sharon Angle, I would say that they have lots of male counterparts already in the Senate, already in the House. Candidates like Ken Buck, who's in Colorado, who said that he should, you know, is running against a female and says that people should vote for him because he doesn't wear high heels. People like John Racey in West Virginia, who has made fun of foreign-sounding names. But we don't see the intense scrutiny on those kinds of statements that we do on people like Angle and Michelle Bachmann. By the same token, I would argue that the House, the Senate, state houses are full of unprepared young men who don't have a firm grasp on the Constitution. This is part, unfortunately, of politics, in which we don't always elect terrific candidates. But I have myself in past elections have interviewed candidates. I was just talking about this in Pennsylvania. There was a young man I interviewed during 2006 for Salon, who was so deeply inarticulate and unable to express himself. But we don't hear about those guys. There is a degree of fetishization that is going on with some of these women who are out there. Why are all the national cameras on Delaware, which is, you know, is...
Oh, I agree. It's way over the top.
It's a small state.
Right.
All we're hearing about is Christine O'Donnell.
Right.
How many men have unexpectedly won primaries, have been long shot candidates, have been deeply unprepared, have said ridiculous things? I mean, we've also been through elections that featured people like Dan Quayle, you know, and there was a degree of ribbing and a degree of ridicule he got. There were jokes often about George W. Bush and his intellect. But the degree of obsessive fetishization is completely different for this set of women. And so while we're seeing a view of some of them that is dismaying, we need to keep in mind that it's also being magnified for reasons that I believe have to do with their gender and a desire on the part of the media to make them look like foolish poster children for women in politics.
Oh, that's very interesting. Let's go to Sarah Palin for a moment. When you heard that she was the VP nominee and when you heard her speak, you thought?
Oh, well, when I first heard her speak, I thought, and again, I'm a Democrat, I thought this woman is terrifying and she's going to be our first female president. That's honestly what I thought. Because though my politics were very different from hers, and I knew that from pretty much the moment I Googled her the morning she was selected by John McCain, what I saw, and it's interesting, we were just talking about how Hillary Clinton presented herself, from the moment that Sarah Palin was presented, she was running as a woman, unapologetically, and she was presenting herself fairly, by the way, as a historic woman. And she was saying, I'm going to break the glass ceiling. She was citing Democrats like Hillary Clinton and Geraldine Ferraro in her first speech to America, saying, I'm going to be the one who carries this ball forward. And I had never seen a woman run like this before. And I, frankly, at that moment, not knowing what we know now about how the decision to pick Sarah Palin was made, thought it was brilliant on the part of the McCain team. And I had no intention of voting for her, obviously. But what I did know was that there was so much resentment about the way that Hillary Clinton had been treated within her own party and the sexism she'd faced and the degree to which Democrats had been unwilling to hail her as a historic, groundbreaking figure and had in fact reviled her and tried to shoo her out of the race. There was so much resentment left over from that I actually thought it was very brilliant of the McCain team to pick a woman, and then this woman was there to do it for herself and say, listen, I'm your history-making candidate. And I thought this is going to be extremely powerful, and it was brilliant. We now know in retrospect that the choice of the McCain campaign to pick Sarah Palin as his running mate was practically accidental. They were not thinking about any of these factors. They were not. They thought she was a charismatic and, frankly, an attractive young woman, and they were trying to get the Hillary voters, but they hadn't put any thought into what it meant to run a female candidate. They hadn't put in any thought as to Palin's experience. They didn't really know that much about her. And, of course, we now know, a little more than 2 years later, that they unleashed a political animal who is unlike any I think we've ever seen before.
Yeah, how true. Do you still think she will be the first female president?
No, I don't think she will be. But I think, that's my gut. I don't think she will be. I think she will run, is my guess. I mean, it all depends. A lot of what happens for Sarah Palin actually depends on what happens next week in these elections. She's got a lot. It's funny. She's not in elected office at the moment. She holds no post in the RNC, and yet she, more than anybody else, probably has, and she's not running herself, but she has more than anyone else riding on what happens next Tuesday, mm-hmm. because she is putting an enormous amount of her own political capital, and she has a lot of it, into pushing this series of candidates. If they win, she will be hailed as a tastemaker and a power player within her party that I think will set her up to run in 2012.
Right, interesting.
If her candidates lose, and in fact have done damage to the Republican hopes, then she will have to regroup and rethink what she's going to do next. So she has an enormous amount riding on next week. If it goes well for her, I do think she will run for president. And who knows? There's no telling what kind of factors could lead to her winning or losing. My gut is that she won't be the first female vice president. She, as we got to know her more along the campaign trail and since, we have learned she is a remarkable political figure, and I find her fascinating. Though I continue to disagree with just about everything that comes out of her mouth. But we've learned that she is unlike anybody who's come before her. She is totally erratic. She's unpredictable. I don't think she has anyone really controlling or advising her. She's entirely independent. She is a true maverick, as advertised. She has also had some troubles in expressing herself, in answering questions, in getting through interviews, and her own erratic nature may make it difficult for her to win the presidency. On the other hand, we have never been able to predict so far what Sarah Palin was going to do.
Right, yeah.
If you had asked me a year ago, in fact, I was writing this book a year ago, the summer, the weekend that she resigned as governor, and I thought to myself, damn.
That's it.
No one's going to want to read my book because no one will care about Sarah Palin by the time it comes out. And how wrong was I?
Right.
She defies every prognostication. So I think we don't know, but I think what we're looking at is a figure who is going to be a player in Republican politics for a long time to come.
Yeah. Thanks, Bob, for your call. Let's go to Alan from Appleton. Hi, Alan.
Hi. I have a question for your guest. I heard a week or so ago, or maybe a couple weeks ago, and then last night I was watching something, and it seems to be growing. A number of the candidates that are running have been using the term man up. Mm-hmm. And to me, that is an incredibly sexist thing to say, and I don't see how there isn't an outcry about using that. I mean, you know, male, female, a guy cannot respond or defend against that without saying something that could get him in trouble. And I'm curious as to what your view is as to why they're not getting in trouble for this.
Well, it is a fascinating question. And I myself have been thinking a lot about what this man up rhetoric means. Part of it is that I think when you have women, so many women candidates out there in the limelight, one of the things we're seeing, not only with phrases like man up, but with other sort of branding phrases like Mama Grizzlies, you know, the Year of the Woman, even Michelle Obama dubbing herself Mom in Chief, all these sort of political catchphrases and one-liners and sound bites that deal with gender. One of the things that speaks to is the fact that when you have a different kind of candidate, when you have these women candidates, and we're beginning to get a little more used to the fact that we have women candidates, so we're not just going with the traditional modes of political expression, people are beginning to play a little bit with the language and to acknowledge gender as a factor in sort of playful ways, branding, and it's often as much of politics is, it's this sort of stupid catchphrasey stuff, right? Mama Grizzlies, man up. It's designed to be an attention-getting soundbite. And so on the one hand, I don't want to be too judgmental of it because I think people are playing with language because we have situations that we haven't dealt with in the political seen before, in which you have men debating with women, women debating with women, and people are trying to figure out how to talk about it, and they're going to make missteps. On the other hand, I agree with you that there, when you're playing with this language, you run into dangerous territory. The Mama Grizzlies thing, for instance, is interesting because it combines the notion of motherhood with the notion of capable leadership, which is progressive, but it also sort of says, okay, but can only mamas be grizzly leaders? Can only women, you know, can only those who have children know how to lead us? And the same thing with man up, because you're right. It is absolutely a troubling phrase because it suggests that there's something, you know, that you need to be more masculine in order to be an effective leader. Well, that's the opposite of what we're talking about. But what we're hearing is an attempt to play with language on a political in the political scene that we haven't seen before, and it's a hypersexual. Instead of what used to happen, which is everybody got de-sexed, right? If there was a woman in the race, you had to behave as though there was nothing unusual about her. What we're now seeing is a sort of hypersexed conversation where everybody's trying to address the gender issue from one angle or another. And that's what I think man up is about. Mm-hmm. But I don't think it's a great thing. It's just part of this process of getting used to having women in the race.
Let's go to Ellen next from Brookfield. Hi, Ellen.
Hi. I had a couple of comments. The first one is that this bunch of women running who are sort of Palin clones, you know, Michelle Bachmann, and you know, they're all attractive and short skirted and obnoxious, for lack of a better word, is very disturbing to me. But the idea that women have to run on anything other than being who they are just has driven me nuts for years. If you want somebody tough, and if you want someone who can say no on a budget, and you want somebody who can discipline, and you want somebody who can deny herself for the betterment of others, it's a woman, and women need to run that way. And I don't think you have to be a mother, but you certainly, you know, and this is not every single woman, but generally it is more the women. you know, a mother is the disciplinarian. A mother is the budget keeper. A mother is the one who says no to her desires for X number of years until the children are raised. And then she has her party. Not that it's drudgery, but she knows when to say no and when to say yes. And she, you know, she allows herself the simple pleasures that she needs. And she does keep the budget. So for me, I have never understood why a woman doesn't run on the virtues and the values of herself as an individual.
Rebecca.
Well, I think that that is, again, the slow process we're beginning to see. I mean, the idea that you can sell yourself as a leader and use your experience as a mother, as you've just described, is brand new. And we are seeing it, perhaps even from candidates we may not like. That's part of what the Mama Grizzly campaign is selling us on. It's also part of how Sarah Palin presented herself, which was groundbreaking. And whatever I think of her politics, which in my case is not much, is sort of undeniably progressive, because one thing we have been lacking in this country is a vision of what a female leader might look like if she's young and a young mother, because we'd always thought, well, if you're a young mother, then you can't have a big political office because we judged you then as a bad mother. And so when Palin first came on the scene and introduced her children, not as liabilities, but as credentials, this was the beginning of a conversation that you're now describing, despite the fact that you right. don't like Sarah Palin and her cohort, which I understand. But this is, we're just beginning to edge into a world in which female candidates can present themselves this way. I just heard the congressional candidate who's been quite besieged in Virginia, Crystal Ball, who has an unfortunate name, is a Democrat and has had a rough campaign, but she too talks about her young baby daughter. She's 28 years old. This is a new world for female politicians. Before, we had a model in which either you could run for office if you were single and childless, or, and Nancy Pelosi and Hillary Clinton are both examples of this, if you had an empty nest. And then, as Nancy Pelosi did, you can sort of say, well, look at all the skills I acquired raising five children, and now I'm going to bring them, you know, to Congress. And that's terrific. But then you get a generation of female politicians who begin so late in their careers that they actually, it's very difficult for them to get enough power either within the body they're governing in, or to, for instance, run for higher office, run for president, run for vice president. It's very hard for them to build that experience. If we want political parity, we need to have a generation of women that feels more comfortable entering the political fray when they're young, even if they have children, even if they're going to have children in office, as Sarah Palin did. And so we're beginning to see that conversation. So I think what you're hoping for, which is an ability to run as yourself, is becoming closer to reality. It is still fraught. The process of selling oneself as a politician, and this is true for women and for men, involves much more than simple truth-telling. There's a big song and dance routine, and this has been true for men for generations, too. And so you're not going to see the kind of clean presentation as often, clean, truthful, direct presentation as often as you'd like to in either male or female candidates. But we are seeing women present themselves unapologetically as female, in many cases as mothers, for the first time in numbers that are still astounding to me. By the same token, we also need to be able to see women who are not mothers and are not apologetic about that. You know, we need to be able to see women of all ages, of all colors, of all sexualities, because there are lots of different versions of real women, you know, and that's one of the things we have to get used to. And that's one of the things we have to get used to, even if the women who are presenting themselves to us don't share our politics.
Rebecca Traister is our guest. Her book is Big Girls Don't Cry, The Election That Changed Everything for American Women. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. And let's go to Frank from Madison, our next caller. Hi, Frank.
Hello, Kathleen.
Hi, Frank.
Your fine guest made an interesting point a bit earlier when she pointed to, the flakiness of some of the comments of male candidates.
Mm-hmm.
It's not restricted to female candidates.
Mm-hmm.
I would like to suggest that touches on something that's extremely important, is that there's a massive disconnect between genuine issues and what is being discussed, if you can use that term in a generous fashion, in the candidacies in this election. The fact that there are two continuing wars, doesn't seem to come up. The fiscal and financial situation, we're on the edge of a second banking crisis with the mortgages. Third, apparently, there isn't a Republican senatorial candidate who will admit that climate change actually exists. So we're in this situation where we have a politics of spectacle. And I'd like to suggest that perhaps some of these female candidates, that is what they are, part of the spectacle. And we could get back to Hillary Clinton in that she had genuine gravitas and competence. So could the guests perhaps look at the female candidacies in that perspective?
Thank you.
We have a major disconnect in our politics. Thank you.
Thank you, Frank, very much.
Well, I would argue that, again, thank you very much for that comment. It's absolutely true. There are female candidates who do have gravitas right now. I mean, think about Patty Murray in Washington, Barbara Boxer in California, and for that matter, candidates like Meg Whitman and Carly Fiorina, whose politics I disagree with and whose behavior I sharply disagree with, but are certainly not of the same mold as Christine O'Donnell and Michelle Bachmann. Think of the gubernatorial candidate, Alex Sink, who's a terrific candidate in Florida. There are a number of extraordinarily competent women out there competing for office this year, and not to mention the women, including Hillary Clinton, including Nancy Pelosi, including Amy Klobuchar and Debbie Wasserman Schultz, and the senators from Maine. And again, I'm trying to not just list people whose politics I agree with, who have terrific gravitas, who are terrifically competent. Part of what we're seeing, and this is also particular to this election, and again, it's being twisted slightly to make it seem as though it's something feminized. We are seeing an election in which a lot of the candidates are extremely conservative, and that doesn't necessarily have to do with their gender. It has to do with the fact that we are in a moment in which there's a tremendous uprising of conservative anger, and by the same token, we're looking at candidates who are part of an insurgency. So, by definition, insurgent candidates are perhaps not going to have been as experienced as those who are already within the system. This goes a long way toward explaining Christine O'Donnell. This doesn't necessarily have to do with the fact that she's a woman, and it doesn't mean that Christine O'Donnell's candidacy represents or can stand in for the candidacy of other women. So, again, we have to sort of get some perspective on the laser focus that we've had on some of the wackier female candidates and think about why that focus has been as intense as it's been. And remember that, in fact, we have a field of both sitting politicians and candidates for office this year that includes large numbers of extraordinary women. But that we don't hear as much about the extraordinary and the competent as we do about the silly and the incompetent.
Thank you very much, Frank, for the call. It's interesting to go back to Hillary for a moment here, that she is in a position where she can be extremely competent and is welcomed by people around the world. And would you say, from talking to those who had concerns about her running, even though they would have been a natural constituency, that they feel that she's very good at what she's done, that this is where she should be?
You mean as Secretary of State right now?
Right. Yes.
Yes. Well, I think there are mixed feelings about this. I think she's doing a terrific job as Secretary of State, and I think she is much beloved as Secretary of State. There are very complicated reasons for why Hillary is as popular as she is right now. I can pretty much guarantee you that had she won the presidency, she would not be popular, both because it's very hard to stay popular while being president, and because, unfortunately, there is something about her having lost that, and Hillary's been through this pattern a number of times in her career, that endears her to people, which is troubling. People are always comforted when they see powerful, ambitious women working well within an organization, which is what Hillary is doing now. She's working well with Barack Obama, and everybody says, oh, great, Hillary, she's really, you know, a member of the team. Of course, this is who Hillary Clinton has always been. But we forget that because we have very little tolerance in this country or very little understanding that team playing, competent, hardworking, diligent, cooperative women can also simultaneously be ambitious, competitive, and want to be president themselves. We see those as two totally separate kinds of women, and we can't always remember that those impulses can exist simultaneously within one complicated person. So we like Hillary when she is playing well with others, which is what she's doing right now. I see, however, there is also a retrospective reconsideration of how she was treated during the presidential race that is working to her benefit. And I think that she's doing a great job in the State Department. I think that she is set up, should she ever want to run for president again, and who knows whether she will or not. She is currently very well set up to do that. I think you can also hear in the media a clamor around the rumor that she might trade places with Joe Biden, and nobody knows whether this is true or not. This is entirely speculative. Nobody knows
right.
if it's true. But the fact that that rumor is so popular goes to show that we want more Hillary Clinton in our lives. We want more. We probably also want more Hillary Obama dynamic. We like the two of them together. They have terrific political chemistry. They appear always to have liked each other. It was fascinating when they were in competition with each other. So I think that Hillary is not going to disappear from the political scene anytime soon.
Okay. Thank you so much, Rebecca, for being with us. Rebecca Traister, the book is Big Girls Don't Cry, The Election That Changed Everything for American Women. Rebecca writes about politics and gender for Salon. Tomorrow during this hour, we will have Broadway legend Patti LuPone with us, so that should be fun. We'll play some Broadway show tunes. Thanks to Chrissy Pease for producing this hour, and thanks to Chrissy as well for on-air production in our downtown Milwaukee studios. Thanks for your calls, everybody. Until tomorrow.